It's Friday, November 5, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The action of Iowa voters to remove three Supreme Court justices in response to the Supreme Court's action to legalize same-sex marriage back in 2009 is sending shockwaves through the judicial and political communities. Writing in the New York Times, A.G. Sulzberger makes clear that the action of Iowa voters has started a very pointed and heated legal debate. The voters of Iowa had the opportunity to remove these judges by ballot, and they did so in direct response to the 2009 decision by the court in which the court declared unilaterally the legalization of same-sex marriage. In other words, they ruled any prohibition on same-sex marriage to be unconstitutional. Mr. Sulzberger's report gets right to the heart of the matter in presenting the great distinction and divergence between those who believe that the citizens of Iowa did the right thing and those who are convinced that they set a very wrong and dangerous precedent. Speaking for those who believe that Iowa's voters were doing exactly what is right was Bob Vanderplaats, who was an unsuccessful Republican candidate for governor and one of the major energizing figures behind the campaign. He said this, "I think it will send a clear message across the country that the power resides with the people. It's we the people, not we the courts." On the other side, Mr. Sulzberger quotes Erwin Chemerinsky, who is professor of law and dean of the University of California Irvine School of Law, a very well-known liberal jurisprudence professor, who said this, "What is really disturbing about this is that it really might cause judges in the future to be less willing to protect minorities out of fear that they might be voted out of office. Something like this really does chill other judges." Now, of course, Mr. Chemerinsky, that's exactly what the voters of Iowa intended to do. They intended to send a chilling message to activist judges who very clearly are acting well beyond the moral and political beliefs of the citizenry of their own state. Now, Mr. Sulzberger's story is really interesting. As he lays out this debate, he makes clear that what was going on when it comes to the actions taken by the Iowa Supreme Court is what could well be defined as leapfrogging. Mr. Sulzberger compares two different political approaches. The first is legislating. To legislate for an issue is to, after all, create a climate of public opinion that makes the legislation possible. Legislators answer directly to the people, and in general, they answer very frequently. Therefore, they cannot get far beyond public opinion, or they risk, of course, being thrown out of office. Now what we have as a judicial option is what Mr. Sulzberger describes as leapfrogging. He says this, "The risk of leapfrogging, or ignoring public opinion on controversial issues, was brought into sharp relief Tuesday when voters chose to remove all three justices who were on the ballot seeking new terms." End quote. Now, was the issue really same-sex marriage? Well, as it turns out, of course it was. The deliberate effort to remove those justices was driven by those who were outraged about that one decision. Further evidence for the fact that it was the singular issue comes to light when it is seen that all 71 lower court judges on the same ballot were clearly returned to office. It was the Supreme Court justices who were singled out, and they were singled out because they had single-handedly leapfrogged over the values and the moral judgments of the people of Iowa in order to establish, by judicial fiat, same-sex marriage. The argument that the court adopted and sent forth to the people was that it is unconstitutional to create any legal barrier to the marriage of persons of the same gender. Now, this gets more interesting. Mr. Sulzberger's report is one of those very valuable pieces of journalism that appears in a major American national newspaper. It turns out that the three justices received about 45% of the vote on Tuesday, which meant they fell considerably short of the amount needed for their reelection. Now, what's interesting as well when you start looking at this is that you have a statement such as that made by Joseph Groden, a law professor who was one of three California judges who lost a reelection bid. He said this, "Obviously, it has an impact on the independence of judges and how they think of their role. I think that's demonstrable." He went on and he said, "There's more than that. I think the damage is not on judges, but that the courts will come to be seen and judges will come to be seen as simply legislators with robes," end quote. Now, my response to Professor Groden is this. The real issue and message that is sent here is that when judges act like legislators, they should expect that the citizens will treat them like legislators. If judges want to have a very clear, distinct role for the judiciary, then they're going to have to act in such a way that they do not, to use Mr. Sulzberger's, I think, very accurate phrase, leapfrog over the moral opinions and convictions of the population, that is, especially of the majority, or they too risk being treated just like legislators who get far out of step. Now, one of the things to keep in mind here is that the removal of judges is not just an issue of voter whimsy. You can look back to 1986 when justices were removed from the California Supreme Court in response to what was seen as the judicial activism of those justices in throwing out the death penalty. Now the issue is not the death penalty, but same-sex marriage. And it turns out that in order to get the size of vote that was required to remove these judges, those who were pushing the effort in Iowa had to convince, and obviously did convince, an overwhelming majority of Iowa voters that this court, and in particular these justices, were far out of line. Now, there are many other things that are interesting here. You have statements from legal experts and from law professors and others who are suggesting that what we have here is the politicization of the courts. But once again, we need to keep in mind that what we have here is an equal and opposite reaction to the action that was taken by the judges. The judges acted politically. There's no doubt about that. And now they're being treated politically. Now, when we start looking at all of this put together, we recognize that the bar of public outrage necessary to remove a judge is very, very high. But in the case of these three justices, each of whom was removed by a very clear vote of the people, it is still the fact that judges do answer to the general population. Now, what appears odd, I think, and perhaps even chilling to many Americans, is that there are a good many law professors and others who think that the judges should not act as if they have to give an answer to the people. But that goes back to the issue that was before the voters of Arizona. Should judges be seen as a judicial elite separate from the population? That's a very dangerous notion. Even though most judges are not popularly elected, there has to be some democratic means to remove judges who act injudiciously, or we're actually not living in a constitutional republic, but we're living in some kind of aristocracy of judges. The action taken in Iowa is certainly going to reverberate around the country for years and perhaps even decades to come. Whether or not it does send the message that proponents of this effort intended to send in Iowa, it is certainly being heard that way elsewhere. And this is one of those issues in which we should be encouraged to know that voters that had an opportunity to take a stand, took it. And they took it, no doubt knowing they would be criticized for the taking. More quickly, I want to turn to a report in the New York Times that actually looks at parallels between who was watching whom on television and how the vote turned out. Brian Stetler, writing for the New York Times, indicates that the viewership for Fox News was huge. Fox News pulled a viewership of 6.96 million viewers during primetime on Tuesday, that is, election night. Now compare that to CNN, which drew only 2.42 million, a tiny fraction in one sense of the Fox audience, and then MSNBC, that was 1.94 million viewers. So if you add MSNBC, which is now perceived to be generally there on the left, and CNN, which has tried steadfastly to remain recognized as something in the middle, you put them together, you're still far short of the almost 7 million Americans who watched Fox. Well, consider that indeed the election was an overwhelming tide, especially in the House of Representatives, in a conservative direction that was driven by Republican candidates. You start to look at this and you realize something is going on here. Now, I guess there could be someone as a dispassionate observer who would look at this and wonder if it's something of a chicken and egg question. Which came first, the conservative population or the viewership of Fox News? In any event, it is a fascinating way to look at the election. And as we look back at Election Day of the midterm election in 2010, it's clear that the same people who were doing the voting were, at least to some considerable extent, doing the watching about the election as well. Of course, they're the ones who had such a direct stake in it. They were stakeholders to the extent that they actually went to the trouble to vote. Now, people have asked me what I watch in terms of news coverage on great big events such as Election Day, and I'll just tell you the truth, I'm very tempted to watch someone I know is going to disagree with me and with whom I'm going to disagree. So I tend to look around, and I tend to try to listen to what each of these major news networks is saying in order to determine where each of them is trying to send a message beyond the mere reporting of the facts. Another political decision deserves some mention. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors voted this week to establish new rules for Happy Meals, or for any meal that offers a free toy to a child. Now, as Jesse McKinley of the New York Times acknowledges, the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco is so liberal that, as he suggests, it sometimes falls between Democrat and Dadaist. It's so far on the left that, in this case, the action taken by the County Board of Supervisors outraged even the mayor of San Francisco, an out-and-out liberal who was just elected on Tuesday as the Secretary of State of California. Now, the board, well, it made a decision that if you're going to offer a Happy Meal, if you're going to offer a free toy, then you're going to have to offer children a healthy meal. Under the bill, any meals will have to have less than 600 calories, less than 640 milligrams of sodium, and less than 35% of calories from fat. There is an exception, by the way, that is offered for nuts, seeds, and a few other exceptions. But what we have here is a government so far on the left that it is going to regulate which restaurants can and cannot offer Happy Meals to children. Now, should we all be concerned about the health of children and diet and, well, what our children are eating? Yes. But to have the city of San Francisco's Board of Supervisors legislate this and make it a matter of law, well, even they recognize they're going over against the desires of parents and others who evidently enjoy taking their children for Happy Meals. I mean, when you think about the role of government and all the legitimate debates about the role of government, you see this kind of overreach by a group of municipal supervisors, and it tells you something of how the political temptation must be incredibly, incredibly powerful. Finally, I have to close the week with a story that has nothing to do with politics and the events of the election. In the business section of Thursday's edition of the New York Times, there is an article about a businessman who needed to develop a website for his business. He was looking at spending multiple thousands of dollars to hire an expert to do it, when, after a conversation with a mother who happened to be a customer, he ended up hiring twin 9-year-old boys to design his website. It turns out they did a phenomenal job. And now these 9-year-olds, who have been transformed by this date into 10-year-olds, have a burgeoning business with more business lined up than they appear to be able to take at present. Boys, Sean and Ross Palladino, have a business on their hands, and the entire society has a quandary on its hands. How do we operate in a society in which 10-year-olds now have more technical expertise in matters of many digital domains than do their parents and their grandparents? This inversion of expertise is a great challenge. It's a challenge to parents, to educators, and to others, but it is also a very clear indication of the digital future. When you've got twin 10-year-old boys who have more business than they can handle creating websites for real-life businesses, well, we're living in a brave new world. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmoeller. Go to sbts.edu for more information about Southern Seminary and DuBoisCollege.com for information about the college. I'll meet you on Monday for The Briefing.